Mr. Chairman, Cecile DeMartini and Sorrel Marks will be presenting this item.
Okay.
Good morning. Did you want us just to address questions, or did you want us to do the quick brief?
Since I pulled this item, I'll tell you what my questions were, and then maybe if you want to, in your presentation, you could make sure you address those. One
sure.
was I was kind of interested in what has generated the changes. Is it state board policy? Is it a regulation? Has staff come up with changes to this permit? And then the two specific things were, and these were raised by both the city and the county's letters, the need now to have a certified analytical result. What did we have before in terms of testing, and why now that change to a certified testing requirement? Who is requiring that? And then, although I'm not as concerned about this, but there seem to be issues raised by Mr. Almy that he wanted workshops and more time to get the potential permit holders up to speed with this. And I would just like staff to kind of address that. How many permit holders out there? Are these permits that last 5 years or just during? They are 5-year permits? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, they change all the time based on what activities someone may be doing. A construction site or something that may be dewatering, that might be a kind of a temporary situation.
Yes.
And there are some long-term permits.
Yeah.
So a combination of things.
Well, depending, many low-threat permits in Royalees could also have the option of going into a construction or industrial stormwater permit if they qualify for whatever their discharge is. So they don't necessarily have to enroll into the low threat permit if their discharge qualifies for any of those other NPDES permits.
Okay.
That's what you're asking.
Okay, go ahead.
Our presentation does quickly discuss, why the changes have been made. It is very brief, and we can put the slides up if it'll make it easier. Okay. Thanks.
While we're waiting, I had a question as to where is the videographer, the video recording consultant, contractor.
I don't know where they are. We'll check into it. I didn't hear that they were not going to be here today. I didn't have a warning.
Okay.
Can everybody see the slides okay?
That's your order.
Yes.
Okay, so essentially Sorrel Marks and I have been working on the modifications to the existing low-threat discharge permit. And I'll just briefly go through maybe the first 5 slides, doing a quick summary of what the major modifications have been and what, just kind of say what what the reason was for it. And then Sorrel can discuss the comments at the end. So essentially, what we're asking today is adoption of this general order. The general order will reissue the region-wide NPDES general permit covering low-threat discharges to surface water bodies. And reissuance of this permit will enable Water Board staff to rapidly enroll common discharges, typically posing little or no threat to water quality. Some of these typical low-threat sources include, but are not limited, of course, to the non-contact evaporative cooling discharges, which is common amongst the food processing facilities, maintenance and hydrostatic testing of water supply wells, tanks, and pipelines, and brine from small desalination facilities to marine waters. And I only posted these three because these actually tend to be the more significant discharge enrollees that we have in the current permit. So as you can see, it's mostly a water supply, some desal plants, and of course a non-contact evaporated cooler.
Could I interrupt you on the brine from desal?
Sure.
Looking at your report, it looked like the cutoff for the sort of size of discharge was so small that I'm trying to imagine who would be what desal. A lab, or I mean, who would have such small? I mean, it's certainly not the pilot project that we approved in September. It's bigger than that, right? And it's certainly not something that would be producing drinking water for a community. So, who could this be?
That's a good question. Actually, the flow that was indicated for desal and desal plants is been set as a guideline.
Oh.
Mostly, not necessarily a
uh-huh.
prohibition. And I think as staff becomes more familiar with the desal plants, that could be a change, you know, as far as the guidelines. But it's not necessarily a limit to be
okay.
enrolled.
We also don't regulate desal plants other than pilot facilities under this permit. Based on an agreement we have with NOAA, we issue individual permits to full-scale facilities.
Again, so I don't know what this would be.
And I'd just like to add that we have in the past had some small sort of skid-mounted desal facilities that have been brought in emergency situations when we have very limited water supply. The one that comes to mind was up at the Hearst Information Center, the Visitor Center, north of San Simeon. But you're right in that this is a very small amount, so larger facilities would likely be covered by an individual permit.
Okay, so this could be an emergency, something that would make emergency supplies easy.
Okay. Actually, Dr. Press, the board or staff did enroll those two pilot projects under this permit, the existing version of it.
Right, but the suggested cutoff here is
okay.
is lower, right, than those.
Right. Okay.
Just so I was just looking at that number and thinking, well, that couldn't be the pilot. They couldn't have been permitted under this new formulation.
They could be permitted under this discharge. That flow limit is a consideration.
Okay. All right. Good enough. Thank you.
This slide pretty much represents three of the more significant proposed modifications to the low-threat permit. And essentially, you know, the question was asked, you know, what is the driving force for these modifications? And that would essentially be it stems from national and state policy, specifically the
yes.
California Toxic Rule, the National Toxics Rule, and the Ocean Plan as modified in 2005. You know, those policies have been adopted in the past 5 years, and therefore staff had to follow through and incorporate that new policy into this proposed low-threat permit. Modifications to this low-threat permit. The mandatory effluent analysis, one of the more significant mods is to the general permit is the effluent analysis required that is going to be required by the applicants and currently enrolled dischargers. Applicants that are currently enrolled and dischargers will be required to analyze effluent samples for constituents of concerns as listed in the new attachment D to this proposed low-threat permit. The constituents of concerns, again, come from the state implementation policy and the Ocean Plan as modified in 2005.
So do those two documents, the policy and then the ocean plan, do they specify that a certified analytical testing be done on effluent?
Yeah, you're saying strictly ocean discharges.
Is your question whether it has to be certified or
yes.
whether the tests have to be done? Well, I think any tests that we require have to be certified or we wouldn't accept them. The issue is whether to do the tests or not.
The issue is what?
I think the commenters were not challenging the requirement that the results be certified, but that they have to do the testing in the first place.
Okay.
One of the comments was, I think there was a perception that doing the testing at using certified methods or approved methods at a certified laboratory was a new requirement, and that is actually not a new requirement.
Okay.
That has always been part of our standard provisions, or at least the current standard provisions are 1984. So it's been there for quite some time. And that is a part of the ocean plan. I must admit I don't recall off the top of my head if it's in the California toxics rule, but it has been part of all of our permits within the standard provisions. It can frequently be overlooked, so we reiterated it in the permit itself.
Well, why don't we go? I think the comment had to do with, and I'd rather just pull it out of the letter, was some of these entities could do their own testing versus having to now go outside and hire somebody. Let's see here. Okay. I'm looking at page 2 of Mr. Almy's letter, and the 1, 2, 3, 4, fifth paragraph down. Furthermore, the new rules require certified analytical results for physical properties at two locations, upstream and downstream of the discharge. These parameters could be measured in situ by the permittee, but are now required to be certified by a lab. This adds to the cost and the complexity of the sampling program. So what is your comment to that?
Well, as I described in the staff report, normally those rather simple tests, the procedures, the certification is for something like temperature, is using a certified thermometer. You would need to have a thermometer that actually is calibrated occasionally. I don't know what the specific time frame is. Some of the other procedures there would need to be done by a lab. And that is part of the...
But you could use a meter to do that. Wouldn't that be just as... doable? I mean, there's dissolved oxygen meters. You could do turbidity and color.
Sure. A lot of these processes are done using meters and can be done using field equipment. But if you're going to do that using field equipment, then you actually need to demonstrate proficiency in doing it by going through the certification process.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right.
That would be typical to like having your scale checked. And they just put a seal on it for a year or 2 years or whatever?
Well, normally with these processes, the certification includes sending blank samples to you, and you run them, and hopefully your results are within the range of acceptability for the test. Now, in addition to that practical side of it, you would need to also have quality control procedures that demonstrate you're going to keep the equipment in appropriately maintained, and you're going to sample in the appropriate method.
Okay. And I see the language here also. It really, what it says is, must have been certified analytical results.
Yes.
It really specify that a lab, outside lab, has to do that. So maybe there's kind of a misunderstanding.
Right. I mean, this, like I said, this is a standard requirement that all of our permittees
right.
have, and okay. some of the more active or larger permittees do the tests themselves. They have the equipment and the adequately trained staff, and others contract it out.
Okay. Dr. Bowker?
Couple of questions. In the case of the situation of seafood processing wash water, how much is organic or nutrient loading an issue, and are we monitoring that issue? I mean, I have no idea exactly what seafood processing wash water is exactly.
You
if you're
know,
washing off the tables, that's one thing. If you're washing out the cans that the goes in, that's something else.
Mm-hmm. I have to say that it's fairly new to myself as well. I have we have one facility enrolled under this permit with that process, and they just started, and we've not received a report from them. But they are required to submit the BOD. And I believe I'll have to double check on total call form, but
well, I was more concerned with nutrient loading issues.
Nitrates.
Not only nitrates, but organics as well, fish parts, that sort of thing. I mean, any level of nutrient loading.
Again, it's fairly new to me, and I'm still waiting to see their first report, unless Sorrel has something to add to it.
In the stipulations, they're not measuring that, so you wouldn't see it in the first report. As I understand, the nutrients or the chemicals we're looking for.
You're saying of the Appendix D constituents?
Right. There's no nutrient organic component to that.
Let's see.
That I could find. Now it may be there.
Mm-hmm. Oil and grease, suspended solids, settable solids, turbidity, pH, and acute toxicity is also part of their enrollment criteria.
But I'm still concerned with the nutrient component and eutrophication potential.
I apologize, what was that one more time?
And eutrophication potential?
It could be.
I'm thinking of something, a system that's fairly closed, like Morro Bay, for example. I mean, that where even small amounts of nutrients could create some difficulties.
Mm-hmm.
Both nitrates and organics, fish parts, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, I'd have to, you know, I'm sure their treatment system would have some sort of filtering of solids.
But the stipulations don't monitor for that, and that would seem to me to be a likely output of fish processing wash water.
Okay.
Dr. Bowker, the monitoring program says right up front that the EO can add requirements specific to a certain discharge. So if there are concerns for nutrients for that type of discharge, the EO could modify the MRP, require that monitoring. The permit itself also has a prohibition on discharge of any waste that is going to cause pollution or nuisance. So if we get the correct information on the discharge or what the expected discharge is going to be like, or what the process is going to be like and what the constituents may be, we can put those in the monitoring program to make sure there's not an issue.
Then that's my misunderstanding then. So in regard to this order, pollution includes more than toxics.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay, I'll continue on here.
Before you continue on, Cecile.
No problem.
Mr. Bowker,
yes.
I just want to point out that on page 10 of the proposed order, item number 4 says that in addition to the requirements of 1 and 2 above, discharges to inland surface waters and closed bays and estuaries must submit certified analytical results of a representative sample of the effluent for the following: total chlorine, pH, nitrate, turbidity, and total dissolved solids.
I still might have a concern on organics, fish parts of small diameter, that sort of thing.
Okay.
Again, if staff sees, you know, an issue with their discharge, you know, and feels that they are not properly and that their discharge wouldn't be qualify for to be enrolled in this permit, we would certainly address that. The dischargers or applicants will also be required to monitor the receiving water body, and what we're asking them to analyze is for pH, temperature, color, turbidity, and dissolved oxygen. And again, this was one of the questions Mr. Young had asked about the comments of how they would do that, and essentially, you know, as long as they have it certified and properly calibrated handheld monitoring device that can do this, I think that will suffice. And this will also assist in staff to see if their discharge has any effect to the surface water body through their results. Contingency plan will be required of dischargers basically with high flows, and essentially it's just for it would start for flows that are 200 gallons per minute or more for a duration of 6 months or longer. Modifications to the reporting program include a startup phase and monitoring report. The enrollees in the general permit will be required to notify Water Board staff 7 to 14 days prior to startup and submit startup confirmation effluent characteristics. And the startup report will be due to Water Board staff 15 days after startup activities. Chemical additives report is all a proposed modification as well. And basically, this will require the discharger to provide Water Board staff with a chemical additives report if the chemicals were not reported in their initial application. And so I can quickly go over the comments.
We did circulate a draft permit and staff report to a large number of interested parties, agencies, current enrollees in the current low-threat permit, and published the notice in newspapers throughout our region. And we received the 4 comment letters that are in the staff report and addressed in the end of the fact sheet. But in general, several of the comments were similar in nature and primarily expressed concern over the extensive monitoring that will be a considerable expense. And we certainly recognize that the monitoring will be more expensive than the initial monitoring required in the current permit, but it is needed to reflect the requirements of both the California Toxics Rule and the updated Ocean Plan. Several of the commenters had asked that a single application be allowed to be submitted for multiple discharges, and the way we had originally worded this provision in the draft, it sounded like all of those discharges had to be within a single basin, and it wasn't really intended to be that way. We look at these on a case-by-case basis, and a lot of the water suppliers, certainly along the south coast of our region, the discharges from a single water supplier can be in several basins, and so we do handle those on a case-by-case basis, and we changed that language so that it would not be limited to a single basin. Then there were also some clarifications of the sources of requirements. Primarily, as Cecile mentioned, they're from the state implementation policy and the updated ocean plan. Following the response to public comments, there's also some clarifications from staff in the end of the fact sheet. And those are mainly about attachment D, which is this very long list of constituents. And you also received a supplemental sheet this morning about some clarification on the use of that list. You know, with potential enrollees to this order, our expectation is that they are truly low threat. And so there are several places in the order where it refers to the discharges complying with all appropriate water quality criteria. So it sort of begs the question, what are those appropriate water quality criteria? And attachment D is a compilation of priority pollutant water quality objectives from the California Toxics Rule, the Ocean Plan, and other pertinent sources that we could find. So that would be used as sort of a yardstick to measure whether a discharge is truly low threat. And initial testing would be measured against that those water quality objectives to demonstrate whether it was a discharge that was appropriate for coverage under this order. Now, what's described in your supplemental sheet is that if initial testing indicated that there were some of these constituents, then there is still the option for the applicant to go through the reasonable potential analysis to demonstrate compliance. Now, I would like to point out that just as we were looking at this table, somehow we managed to get ammonia in there twice with two different numbers. So the incorrect listing on, this is attachment D, page 4, and it's approximately halfway down the page, right under inorganics. It says ammonia is N from the Ocean Plan, and it's listed there at 6,000. That should actually be 600. On the following page, it's listed as 600, which is correct.
Okay, so the criteria in attachment D are simply used as a screening process.
Yes.
To make sure the discharge, in fact, is low threat.
Yes.
Okay. And then the testing requirements that are done throughout the permit are found where?
The monitoring requirements?
Yes, the monitor.
That would be in the monitoring and reporting program.
Right. And those are, why don't you direct me to the page in the order?
Let's see. That's it's attachment B, and it starts right after the order. I think following the order, there's the notice of intent, and
right.
Then there's the notice of intent, which is the application form, and then there's the monitoring program following that.
All right, so essentially what's on page 6.
Right, but as mentioned earlier, for unique circumstances, we can add things that we might need to that.
Okay. And how many, Sorrell, how many enrollees do we currently have under this permit, the existing permit?
I think we currently have 47.
And do you happen to know
they
how
have a tendency to sort of come and go because sometimes they're one-time sort of discharges. And So the number changes quite rapidly. You know, as you see them in the regular agendas.
Mm-hmm. Any idea how many you have it broken down by county?
No, we don't.
Okay. All right.
Okay. There's one other item that I wanted to point out, and that is in the fact sheet on page 6, in the first column, there's an enrollment criteria G, and this is just a clarification issue, and that criteria summarizes some CEQA requirements. It doesn't show up in the permit because it's just a reiteration of CEQA requirements. The requirements that exist under CEQA but not separate requirements for this permit. So it doesn't show up in the permit itself. So I just wanted to clarify why that's not there. And if there's any other questions, we'd be happy to try and field them.
Right. Any board questions? I have one speaker card. Mr. Almy? Yes.
Could I just back up?
Of course.
1 minute. You had asked in the beginning about the public education, public workshop.
Right.
And I don't think we touched on that issue.
Right.
And because each of the discharges is normally fairly unique under this program, we normally deal one-on-one with the applicants. The public hearings that we've had have mainly been each time this permit has been renewed. And I think initially when the board adopted this permit several permits ago, we had several hearings then, but then there's just been one public hearing each renewal. So this would be the third renewal. And primarily the interaction is one-on-one with the applicants.
Okay. Mr. Almy.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Robert Almy. I'm the manager of the Santa Barbara County Water Agency. First, I think what I heard your staff say is there's been no public workshops. I think that's what I just heard. And I am also interested in the notion that they're not sure how many people or how many organizations are affected by this regulation. But I'll speak to the county. I do carry a letter from the Carpinteria Valley Water District dated November 30th. Dear members of the board, the Carpinteria Valley Water District received the proposed changes to this permit on November 20th, 2006. This, in our opinion, was not sufficient time for review and comment. From a preliminary review, it appears that the monitoring requirements have become inconsistent with the intent of low threat to water quality discharges. The idea of low threat should not require a higher degree of monitoring for constituents that are unlikely to ever be found in these types of discharges. We've reviewed the County of Santa Barbara Water Agency's letter dated October 16th and concur with their concerns regarding monitoring requirements and permit enrollment requirements. We request that the board consider extending the comment period and take no action on this item until sufficient review by all affected agencies can be completed. That's their letter. My comments are a little more, a little different. I want to give you the perspective of the Santa Barbara County Fire Department, which serves communities throughout the region, and by my count, uses water from about 8 different public water districts or water agencies. These sources of water have their own water requirements, drinking water standards, and the prospect here is that the fire department, in the business of running tests to determine the adequacy of flow for emergency response, is going to need to do a bunch of sampling and be required for permits. And as I'm looking at your effluent monitoring schedule here, the only one that seems to relate to the any kind of impact that could occur might be residual chlorine. Everything else seems to me to be covered by the kind of monitoring that public water aid districts are to do through the Department of Health regulations, and that they do as a matter of course. So I look at this, and I think that this whole process would benefit by a lot more input from the regulated community, because I think there are some things that can streamline and help with the efficiency, so that public agencies don't have to spend a lot of time and effort to do things that they're not really that's not really in their main mission. Those are my comments. Thank you.
With respect to the fire department, you're referring to the fire hydrant, what do you want to call it, flushing that happens?
Yeah, that's correct. And I appreciate the notion of having a broader single permit to cover this, but it's really, when you think about it, it's the testing and the permitting that of what amounts to drinking water discharge that people... When we have taken the time to alert our fire department, because they weren't aware of this, this permitting, they kind of scratch their heads and say, we just don't see this. We don't understand what's going on here. We don't see the benefit. Like every other public agency, we have a restricted budget. You guys know all about that. This is going to take time and effort, and we don't see the benefit. We don't see the benefit here. Yeah. I know what you guys are trying to do, but I think... it could, the whole process could be made more efficient.
Yeah, Sorrel, fire hydrant flushing water needs to be under a low threat permit. Can you?
Yes, if it's discharging to a surface water.
I can. Address
Mr. It is a little strange. I mean, if it's drinking water. It's the chlorine issue, but is that the only testing requirement then for a fire hydrant flush water? Or do they have to go through this whole process of going through attachment D to make sure it is?
Well, you know, the as said earlier, the modifications stem from, and these analyses of constituents' concerns stem from state implementation policy and the Ocean Plan. In the application requirements of this proposed order, it specifically states on page 9, section or A2 of the application requirements, that unless the discharge meets requirements for a conditional exception under the State Implementation Policy Section 5.3 or solely an ocean surface water discharge, then the applicant will be required to monitor or analyze for the Appendix D constituents. And essentially a conditional exception from the state implementation policy includes drinking water testing, and which also to fulfill requirements of the Drinking Water Act and essentially to Department of Health Services, and it includes maintenance of pipes, flushing, water supply reservoirs, canals, cleaning and maintenance. And so the fire hydrant flushing is what could be considered as a conditional exception if they are performing these flushing operations under this Drinking Water Act requirements. So essentially they would not have to analyze for the Appendix D constituents.
But would they have to apply for that conditional exception? Would they have to get that approved ahead of time?
As far as the application requirements, if they do meet that if they believe they meet that exception, they just have to provide some information detailed out on page 11, essentially a detailed description of their draining and water supply pipes, maintenance and stormwater conveyance systems program, their time schedules, and this is all from the state implementation policy.
I'm assuming the fire hydrant flushing is an issue because they're releasing to storm drains, which then go to, right? So The perverse result might be that we would require them to enroll here, but somebody who's overwatering their lawn and the water is then going into the storm drain would not have to do anything about this. So can you give us a sense of how difficult it would be to comply with the conditional exception?
You know, the exception requirements essentially are basically, you know, what their management plan, what, you know, what their schedule is for doing the maintenance, you know. And I would believe that some of these county and city organizations have, you know, an annual plan of how often they need to flush their pipes, do maintenance. There is some CEQA documentation that is required for the flushing or the maintenance of their system, so that may be a little
because
something they don't already have, that could be an issue, but for the most part.
How is this currently being handled? Are they enrolled right now for fire hydrant flushing? So this would be
the majority of our low threat permits enrollees are water supply systems and
specifically and
some
for
county
fire hydrant flushing. Mr. Allman is shaking his head no.
The majority that I've worked with, and this will be in San Luis and northern Santa Barbara County, are water suppliers with discharges not specifically hydrant flushing, but things like flushing lines for maintenance, for testing, for a variety of different standard activities for water suppliers. Some communities have also enrolled for hydrant flushing if it was discharging to an area where it was obviously going to go into a surface water. And certainly our primary concern there is chlorine and the velocity of the water. So if those two issues are addressed, you know, we are talking about drinking water in those circumstances.
Well, we are. Even if there's chlorine in it, I mean, it's an amount of chlorine that supposedly we could be drinking in our domestic supply. So how can...
That's true, but that can be much higher than organisms in a receiving water can withstand.
And the aquatic criteria are in many cases much more stringent than the MCLs for drinking water, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Aren't we missing the point? If you read the regs and it says you're exempt, you don't need to sign up.
Right.
So it's a moot point at that.
Well, they're not exempt.
Actually,
from
the exception is from the monitoring for all that huge list of constituents.
Mm-hmm. So they still have to enroll.
Yeah.
Under an exemption.
Go ahead, Mr. Allman.
I think I want to, if I can, make a distinction between incorporated cities that provide their constituents with a group of services that includes water supply and public safety. And for them, this is a very different set of issues because they can, because they own, operate, maintain a drinking water supply that is also tested by their own fire department. For them, dealing with these issues is different than places where the water, from a bureaucratic standpoint, from a permit getting standpoint, the technical issues remain the same. I mean, I'm not here to argue the technical side of this. And I agree with the chlorine business and all that other stuff. I'm not, and velocity. The point here, though, is that if there is an exception for water supply system maintenance, that is not going to be applicable to the fire department because that's not what they're doing. And now, as a matter of policy, if you would like to include that in the exception, then that would be a step in the right direction. But as it stands now, I don't believe that a plain read of fire hydrant testing is done by the fire department to see that, to make sure they know how big a piece of equipment to send out if there's a fire, because that's really what they're doing, is they're trying to figure out how they're, you know, how big a pumper and whether there's enough water. And I don't think a plain read would say that that is a water supply maintenance effort. But as a matter of policy, if you would like to help that along, then maybe that's something you could do. But that, the point here is that we're talking about areas that don't have a unified set of services. And the suggestion isn't to handle this a certain way today necessarily, but the point, I think, is that there is room for more public input and more coordination.
Ms. Marks, what about that suggestion in terms of, I mean, would fire hydrant flushing activity qualify under the exemption?
Fire hydrant flushing isn't specifically called out in the exception.
Okay. Do we have the authority? Do we have the authority to broaden that?
No.
Okay.
No. We're talking about the state implementation policy. It's an exception that's expressly written in there. And it doesn't address fire hydrants directly. I suppose the standpoint we were looking at it from is, if these are part of the water supply system, supplied from the same source, and the constituents that are being monitored here, water suppliers would have that sort of data from the source. So we wouldn't necessarily need it separately. But if you had a water supply that was feeding a fire fighting equipment, you know, let's say you wanted to test firefighting equipment from some untested source of water, you would need, and the discharge was going to go into a surface water, you would need to monitor it. The alternative would be keep it on land.
Is the fire hydrant draining for maintenance? Because the SIP does say the categorical exemption applies to draining water supply, reservoirs, canals, and pipelines for maintenance.
They're sometimes drained for maintenance, and there's other equipment is tested for capacity.
Isn't that maintenance?
So that would be maintenance.
I mean,
But I think
the example that was provided is if they are not part of the community water system. You know, I'm just going from a hypothetical, but I think what the example that was being provided, if I'm not mistaken, was if the fire equipment is being tested from something other than the community water supply, and from a source of water that doesn't have the background. Am I missing the mark here?
Let me name communities without trying to hypothetically. The Vandenberg Village Community Services District supplies its customers from wells. They test regularly pursuant to the Department of Health regulations, and those information are publicly available and sent to their customers. The County of Santa Barbara provides emergency services, police, fire, and flood control. And as a matter of course, the fire department goes out and tests various points in the system to make sure that if there's an emergency, they know how to respond and what they're going to have available to them. That work by the fire department is different than the maintenance and operation of the facilities by the Vandenberg Village Community Services District. And there are a number of communities throughout the county where that situation occurs, where there are unincorporated areas in which special districts, different special districts, provide water supply services versus fire suppression, fire response.
But is the testing done by the water supplier sufficient testing to meet the requirements under this permit? to get it certified as being, you know, low threat.
I can't actually answer that. I'm not really familiar with the sorts of circumstances that
it would be like a private contractor testing the water or doing the maintenance for the system, because essentially that's what they are. If the county is providing the service for Vandenberg Village, and they're there testing or maintaining, well, when they flush the system or test the system to see that they have enough water, that's maintenance, because they have to maintain that the system will work. And if it doesn't, then they have to get it fixed. So it has to be.
Yeah, I don't think the distinction is whether the same entity is providing the drinking water and the fire suppression water.
I think we're just we're getting off key here. I think
there's some situations where there's water that's too polluted to serve for drinking water that's still used as fire suppression water, and that would be a circumstance that staff would have to look at. But,
right.
You know, if you're using polluted water, then it should be tested.
Right. I mean, you know, we've had requests to use recycled water for fire equipment testing. So, you know, what I was trying to describe were sources other than drinking water.
Okay.
And those other sources would not fit the exception, but drinking water.
Well, isn't well Mr. water Chair? Drinking water?
That's drinking water.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Who owns the hydrants? The fire department or the water folks?
Depends on the location.
No, it's always the water system.
It's always the water system. Okay,
yeah,
good.
It's whether it's a city or a special
okay,
district.
Good.
They own all the hardware.
So why is the fire department in these situations where they're releasing water from a hydrant that they don't own, why are they considered the discharger and not the water entity who owns the water? I can't see why the fire department is even involved.
Well, if they're doing the testing, they're discharging.
Okay, so if I hire a contractor to come out and discharge some water from my land, you're going to go after the contractor, or are you going to come after me? I don't see why the fire department is considered the discharger. They're merely the guys who are testing the system to see if it has adequate supply to deliver the water behalf of the people who own the water.
If the supplier wants to come in and get the permit, I'm sure we could consider that as well, but I think
that's fine. I don't know why we're dragging that.
I mean, I don't think that distinction determines whether or not the exception applies. Even if the exception doesn't apply, though, under the new language, can't the county just come in and get one enrollment for all of their facilities countywide and just do this all at once so that there's no public emergency or public health issue?
Yes, if you're talking about all of similar facilities.
Well, the maintenance activities involved with their water supply lines. I mean, that's the category I would see.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Any other board questions or comments?
Have we resolved this?
Well,
is there some language we can put? I mean, I know it's a state.
We've got a state policy.
It's a state policy, but can we put some policy of our own language into the permit?
No, and I don't think it's necessary because it says that if it's exempt, they can seek an exemption under the SIP. So if it's exempt, they just come in and
let me ask you this on the exemption. Who do they apply to the exemption for, the state or us?
Us.
Okay.
They would just include in their notice of intent a description of why they meet the exception.
And this is an exception to the monitoring requirements.
Yes.
Okay, so we don't need... Okay.
Yeah.
The language is already in the permit.
Well, does the board feel that flushing of hydrants, which may not be an actual, I mean, it's not discussed in the implementation policy, but it seems like because it's dealing with really drinking water.
And it is a maintenance issue.
That it is a maintenance. It is.
Yeah.
Because you don't want to go open that fire hydrant and have it not work.
So can we put that into the permit?
Staff
that's
knows how we feel about that exemption. All right.
There's no reason to.
Okay.
And there, you know, there may be situations where that's not the case for some reason.
Yes. Mr. Jeffries.
Mr. Allman really hit the nail on the head. It's not so much that they're flushing the hydrants. What they're actually doing is testing the flows. And there's a requirement every year that each city or each fire district report the amount of flows and the pressures that they have, because your fire insurance is based on those reports. And if there's not enough flow to take care of that particular fire in that area, then your fire insurance is going to go up drastically. And that's the reason the fire departments go out and they check those yearly to make sure that those areas have adequate water flows. My question then, and I may be way off missing the point, you're talking about fire suppression. Even if they have a fire and they're using that water, do they have to get a permit for the discharge from that fire? And the state forestry that just comes along and picks up buckets out of lakes that are not monitored and dumps it on wilderness areas that have streams, is that being monitored before they dump it? I mean, how far do we go with this? Am I going too far? Zora?
Interesting questions, though.
Well, because when you got a fire, they take care of whatever they have.
No, they're not being monitored, and I don't think, and I think, no, there's not an expectation that they would enroll under this permit. And I just don't want to miss the other questions that were in there. You know, maybe we should just back up a little bit. The intent of this permit, the original low threat permit, when it was adopted about what, a dozen years ago, about 10 years ago, was that we had a variety of discharges that technically could be considered discharges of waste, but they were of such low potential threat to water quality that we had not been regulating them under a permit. We didn't, at the time, have an efficient way to do that. And this permit was adopted to cover those in an efficient manner. And so it, by its very nature, it's a one-size-fits-all sort of permit. But the issue of what is actually considered a discharge of waste that needs a permit is probably outside the scope of this particular permit. If it needs a permit, then, you know, this is our most efficient way of covering it if it's a low threat. But the question of you know, firefighting water or any other discharge that could in some way impact water quality, I guess, is not addressed in this permit or the staff report.
I would hate to think my fire department would have to get a permit before they came out to put my fire out of my house. I think that's...
Mr. Chairman.
And I'm not aware of any requirement for them to do so.
Yeah. But I think that's what kind of did bad around.
Okay. Mr. Thomas?
Yeah, I was going to say that I agree with Ms. Marks. There's no requirement for that to happen. And I don't think anyone is suggesting that. And I'm going to suggest that the board adopt the permit as proposed with the understanding that staff will consider requests from dischargers to consider exemptions for things like maintenance on fire hydrants. I don't think there should be a categorical exemption for any discharges from fire hydrants. I think that we should get a description of what the discharges are intending to do. For instance, you could turn on a fire hydrant and have it have a very large flow into an area that's susceptible to erosion and have a large discharge of sediment into a storm drain or into a creek, and we wouldn't want that to happen. So I think that we can do in this case, we can do what we normally do, is review the information and make a reasonable decision based on that. I don't think we're getting into a situation where we're going to be overly burdensome on fire departments and prevent them from putting out fires or seeking a permit before they go to put out a fire.
So what you're saying, Mr. Thomas, is that you're putting it out there to the regulated community that they ought to consider an exception, and you're signaling to the staff that the staff should be receptive to exceptions that make sense.
Yes.
To kind of trust that everybody will have common sense.
Yes, and if we don't, I'm sure that you'll hear about it in the regulated community.
Right.
Well, we don't have the authority to create new exceptions to the SIP. The issue is what fits within the exception, but I think that's what we're all talking about. But the other thing is, this permit doesn't say who has to get coverage. It says if somebody wants to sign up for this general permit, these are the requirements, just like the permit before it did. So any discussion of should this guy or that guy get permit coverage is beyond the scope of what we're doing today.
And these typically come up in our agenda as having been issued by staff.
Yes.
Right, and some of them are brought to the board for a hearing before staff approves it, like the two D-cell pilot projects.
Right, and then an applicant can always, you know, if they don't like how the permit is being drafted, could always take it up directly to the board.
To this board or to the state board.
Yeah.
If their NOI is denied, they can file a petition.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, can I ask one more question?
Sure.
So how would it be handled if a fire hydrant has been knocked over and it flows for several hours before it's shut off or time, and there's a great amount of flow? And if it discharges, say if it's in a rural area, it discharges to a waterway of some kind. In a city, it probably goes to the storm drains and then out.
Can I answer that question? Since that would be an accident or an emergency, it's not something they would seek permit coverage for in advance. And typically when things like this happen, like when there's major upsets because of unusual storms at treatment plants, as long as the follow-up is appropriate and expeditious and there's no violations of mandatory minimum penalties, staff doesn't recommend any enforcement action. So in that situation, as long as the response was appropriate and preventive maintenance was appropriate, then it's unlikely that we would take any action.
Then it should be made clear to the individuals. Because that, you know, I could just see all kinds of things that could be generated out of that. What happens if this happens and so forth. Okay.
Okay. Any other board discussion or comments? Okay. Staff is recommending that we adopt order number R3-2006-0063.
Move staff recommendation.
I'll second it.
Okay. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. The item carries. We'll take a break for about 10 minutes or so, and then we will resume with the enforcement report, item number 14.